Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate the love and the support that you all have been giving. Today we're going to do the monthly wrap-up. We have some interesting stories that I want to discuss. Now, of course, these are not going to be a total, every single interesting story, every single police story, every single story that may have made headlines, but it's just a small snapshot of what's going on. And I'm trying to give a broad overview of different ideas that we take from the month, from different months, in order to get them to see what the state of police work is in relationship to the public's attention, public love, public interest. And so that's the purpose of it, not just to talk about every single police story, but stories that show why there is such a contrast in animosity between the police and the public. And so we're just going to take a look at a few of those stories. So before we get into it, as good housekeeping we always do, make sure that you please support the podcast through Venmo, PayPal, Cash App. All of those are all CPTL Hunter, whether it's, you know, go to $CPTL Hunter or whatever, at CPTL Hunter. For PayPal, it's LawrenceHunter/CPTL Hunter. Make sure that you check out my blog on LMH Police Training and Consulting. I have not blogged recently, but I do plan to make sure that I get into it a little bit more within a few coming weeks and months. So that's going to be LMH Police Training and Consulting. HunterPoliceTraining.com is the website, HunterPoliceTraining.com. If you're a police officer out there, remember, if you have some need of assistance for an upcoming promotional test, make sure you hit me up. If you are someone who wants to become a police officer, not sure about the process, you want to take some tests beforehand, see how the testing process goes, I can walk you through the oral interviews and things like that. So just make sure that you hit me up for all of those types of things. Follow me on Instagram, on Twitter, CPTL Hunter for both of those. Also on Facebook, Captain L Hunter. Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. So without further ado, let's jump into just a little bit about what's going on or happened this month. One of the biggest stories, and before we started with all that, is if you've listened to any of my past episodes, one of the more popular episodes was Black Man with a Gun, Ken Blanchard. He is going to be stepping down from the Black Man from a Gun podcast. He does still plan to do more podcasts according to his Facebook page. I do plan to have him back on the show, but in the meantime, he's going to be stepping away from that. He's got over 600 plus episodes that can still be downloaded and listened to. That's Black Man with a Gun. So make sure you check out my episode, my interview with him, Ken Blanchard, Black Man with a Gun, as well as go over to his page, Black Man with a Gun, and just make sure that you try to listen to a number of his episodes. Once again, he's going to be stepping down from that particular platform. However, he does plan to start a new podcast. We will be on the lookout for that, and we wish him much love and much success going forward. So in the state of Illinois, second largest police department, Chicago, they lost their superintendent. He is going to be retiring. Eddie Johnson stepping down from his post with them. Apparently, they had some controversy. There was a situation, according to the New York Post, in which he was coming home late one night, fell asleep behind the wheel of the car he was driving, stopped by his own police department. As a result of this investigation that he ordered himself, he is going to be stepping down. Apparently, he did not have the confidence of the new mayor there, Lightfoot. She stated, once again, according to the New York Times, that he had been drinking the night before. Now, Johnson states that he fell asleep according to the medications that he was taking. Apparently, he's got some ongoing medical issues. He's 59 years old. Nevertheless, he's got enough time, and he's reached the highest heights of the police world as far as becoming a chief of police in the second largest PD in America. We wish him much love and success in his endeavors going forward. It's not easy being in law enforcement, period. It's not easy being in a middle manager, and it certainly is not easy being the manager of a large police department. When everything goes right, you get the accolades. When everything goes wrong, you get the blame. It's hard to walk that fine line of appeasing the public, appeasing the parents, appeasing the students, appeasing the politicians, and then you have to appease your employees, who often feel as if their hands are being tied and cuffed and asked to do more of within their society. So it's not an easy job, but he ascended to those heights, took on the mantle, took on the task. And certainly I'm sure that we, as members of law enforcement, appreciate his efforts. Might not always achieve the results that we want, but we appreciate the efforts. So in another story, I went to a drug reform conference fairly recently. The purpose of this conference was just about how they would strategize with trying to legalize marijuana and a number of other drugs. I am not in favor of people using drugs. I do believe in some forms of legalization and decriminalization. So I certainly enjoyed the conference. I did learn a lot. I have a number of episodes already recorded that will be coming out, dealing with and talking about different aspects of the drug reform agenda. And I interviewed a number of doctors, number of PhDs, lawyers, and people who are just involved with decriminalizing the drug trade. And so just be on the lookout for a number of these episodes, which will be coming out. In line with that, I thought I came across a very interesting story from Forbes magazine. And this is called Reasons Marijuana Legalization Seems to Be Failing. Now, this may be just a propaganda piece, but, you know, Forbes magazine is pretty reputable. Maybe this is just a reason just to get people not to buy into the whole marijuana legalization debate. But they seem to be saying, according to this article, it seems to be saying that the whole debate is failing. Just a little bit from this article, it says one of the biggest arguments made by cannabis advocates when trying to sell their spiel to politicians and voters was that legal weed would eliminate the black market. This, they said, would make it more difficult for children to get their hands on pot than in decades past, while generating significant tax revenue for the state. But the underground pot trade hasn't really gone anywhere. In fact, it's only growing now that the criminal organizations have the luxury of being domestically based instead of running distribution from Mexico. All one needs to do is take a look at California, which legalized the leaf a couple of years ago, to see that this is true. While the Golden State has predicted to rake in $640 million in pot taxes in the first year, it collected about half of that. This is because the black market continues to dominate leaps and bounds over the legal sector. High taxes, the highest in the nation, and licensing issues are said to be the cause of the mess. A recent forecast from BDS Analytics and ARC Market Research suggests that it could take 5 years before the legal market begins to outsell the underground. Once again, what people have to understand is, and I had this conversation when I went to a legalization reform conference debate in Danbury, Connecticut, a few weeks ago. It makes no sense to more in taxes and fees, which obviously is passed on to the consumer, than the street pusher charges. So I don't know what the going rate is right now, I gotta be honest. But if the going rate for a dime bag is, let's just say, $10, and with taxes and fees and all that kind of stuff, you're paying $15 from a legit, and I put that in air quotes, vendor, because of the purity tests and all these other fees that you have, who are people going to go to? So you have to be able to make sense of what you're going to do. You have to charge that $10 and or $8 or $9, right, in order to get them to drive sometimes all the way across town to get to the street, to get to the more legitimate person, rather than the person who they've been used to going to who's charging $10, right? So you cannot set up the practices that are going to be cost prohibitive. That needs to be made sense of. A little bit more from the Forbes article. Furthermore, the black market in legal states is carrying over to areas of prohibition as well. It is part of the reason that the counterfeit vapes, said to be making so many people ill and even killing some, have become so prevalent. Law enforcement agencies all across the country have also been complaining that people trafficking pot in from legal states is making their jobs more difficult. Diehard cannabis advocates might argue that all of the black market madness exists because of conflicting federal and state law. There was even a point where I would have been inclined to agree that federal prohibition is the real monster behind all of this ruckus, but I'm not convinced at this juncture, at least not 100%. Why? Well, just take a look at the North in Canada, where marijuana has been legal nationwide for the past year. It's the black market that is still way stronger than the legal sector. Once again, this has to do with price. I'm not reading from the article anymore. Once again, this has to do with price. In order to be competitive, you have to bring down these costs. And as long as there's taxes and these other fees, then people are obviously going to do what's more convenient, number one, cheaper. I mean, if you had to drive 10 miles in order to get that fix and still pay even the same price, why would you not just call up your boy who lives next door and get it for the same price? So you gotta make sense of all this kind of stuff, right? So these regulations and dispensaries are not always going to be the most convenient and or the most profitable. As a matter of fact, a recent report from the Associated Press indicates that nearly 43% of the country's pot consumers continue to buy weed from illegal sources, and doing away with the black market is the entire reason that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau set out to legalize weed in the first place. Back to the article, still reading from the article again. Many consumers complain that they simply cannot afford to buy marijuana through legal channels. It's one of the reasons that some pot firms have started producing budget weed for stoners. Budget weed. Can you imagine this? Meanwhile, the cannabis industry continues to perpetuate the myth that most of the cannabis users are upscale and have no qualms whatsoever about dropping buku bucks on craft cannabis. While the growing and selling of marijuana was once touted as a great job creator, medically-led cannabis firms have begun laying off hundreds of employees as of late. Canada-based producer Hexo is slashing 200 jobs, while Canna Trust is cutting 140. In the U.S., Ease recently announced that it was eliminating 36 positions. The popular Weed Maps is also trimming fat, and the company will get rid of 100 employees, right? So you gotta cut down on the regulation. This is going to drive people back to the black market. Believe it or not, in spite of more states bringing weed into the mainstream, the latest FBI crime data shows that police forces in America still busted more people for pot last year than they did in 2016 and 2017. While over 500,000 people went to jail for marijuana possession during that time, right? So there's still this war on drugs, even though it's legalized in many places, even though in states like Florida, if you get pulled over for any type of traffic violation and the police officers smell weed in the car, that is not probable cause to then detain you, search you, et cetera, et cetera. I believe the same thing is also going on in Baltimore, where Marilyn Mosby has taken a very hard and aggressive stance. So until this whole war on drugs thing calms down, you're still going to have people who are very fearful and will not engage in this idea and in this product. So let's move on to another story. Speaking of Marilyn Mosby, the district attorney down in Baltimore, there's a story in the Baltimore Sun where she was at a conference, and I truly wish that I had attended this conference. The name of the conference that she was a part of, it was a fall symposium at the University of Baltimore Law Review. It was headlined and called 400 Years, Slavery and the Criminal Justice System. This is what she said during her speech at this particular conference. Black people are six times more likely to be arrested and become part of the criminal justice system than whites, Mosey said at the fall symposium. You have an over-militarization of police departments all across the country, racially unjust application of laws against poor black and brown people, and collateral consequences of these convictions that have kept black and brown people and communities as second-class citizens. You really want to know about the second-class citizen state that people have? I mean, the lack of voting, lack of the ability to go to colleges, lack of affordable housing, lack of public assistance, can't get food stamps if you come home from prison, all these different scarlet letters, as Michelle Alexander put it in her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. If you have not read that book, you really need to read that book. I highly suggest anyone who's really concerned about social justice, criminal justice reform, police, what's going on in society, really should check out that book. It's just a good, great read. So anyway, in this book, she says having this a felony conviction is almost like having a scarlet letter upon your chest. People can see who you are. You are then blackballed. You are then eliminated, cut out from society. And it really is just a negative mark upon your body and upon your and your ability to get ahead, to move ahead, really is extremely hampered. And I've had many conversations about this. And as long as people have this on them, they can't progress in society. I mean, think about it. You have paid your debt to society. Whatever crime they have done, they have committed, they have paid their debt to society. And we as the government and we as the people, right? The people are the government, should be at least, make it extremely difficult for people to forgive themselves and to get over and get by and get through the things that they have done. And as we can see that she believes that Miss Alexander believes that this is done intentionally in order to keep a certain criminal class, a criminal element, to increase recidivism, to keep people out, to keep people on the lower streams and make sure that these lower end jobs are done and eliminated even from the voting polls and from the rolls of potential voters. Her comments, back to the Baltimore Sun article featuring Miss Marilyn Mosby. Her comments were just some of many Saturday from prosecutors, from defense attorneys, law students, academics, and other community stakeholders that sought to center the legacy of racial injustice in a conversation on how best to move Baltimore and Maryland forward. As some of the most influential stakeholders in a system, Mosby said prosecutors like her have an obligation to reduce disparities by providing opportunities for young people before they come in contact with the system. Alternatives for returning felons who are too often sidelined economically because of their criminal records and means for seeking redress for those wrongly accused or convicted. Mosby cited efforts by her office to do all of the above, including her hosting of youth events, her decision to stop prosecuting marijuana possession in Baltimore, her successful push to vacate convictions that hinged on the word of corrupt police officers, and her office's conviction integrity unit, which reviews past cases thrown into question by new evidence. Continuing with the Baltimore Sun article, it says, across town at Morgan State University, a separate forum, which was called Lynching in Maryland, The Journey from Truth to Reconciliation, was hosted Saturday by the Maryland Lynching Memorial Project. The effort is aimed at assessing and dismantling the entrenched legacy and ongoing impact of the lynchings of Black people in Maryland, including 41 cases documented in the state from 1854 to 1933. The issue of restorative justice was discussed, just as it was at the University of Baltimore, but also considered were the efforts of racism on the health of Black Americans, the need for restorative practices in Baltimore and high schools, and structural racism and segregation that still exists in the state's higher education system. So they got a lot going on down there in Baltimore and in Maryland concerning the racial justice forum they have, looking at the two racial justice forums they had, one looking at mass incarceration, and at the same time they were looking at the historical legacies of lynching, and also the present ideas concerning racism on health. That is an idea that I wanted to do a show on, both of those particular shows, especially the one about racism and health. You know, Black people have higher blood pressure, a higher risk of diabetes, mental health, all surrounding the ideas of this entrenched idea of racism in their having to navigate in this world that they live in, and having to deal with racism. I am actually reaching out to people currently in order to get people on the show to talk about the history and the legacy of racism and how it has affected health. In fact, I read one article that talked about racism is a public health crisis. If we want to reduce a lot of the public health situations, particularly around Black and brown people, then we can reduce that risks, like I said, of diabetes, high blood pressure, in some cancers by reducing racism. In fact, a couple of articles that people can read that help to illustrate this point is, number one, Racism Harms Health. And this is from the hsph.harvard.edu from Harvard University. that's the Harvard School of Public Health. Is an article that was written some time ago, I believe in 2013, Racism Harms Health. And there's a professor, Nancy Krieger, Department of Social and Behavioral Sciences. This is from the fall 2013 Centennial Issues. In fact, one of the quotes that I can read from here is, in 1996, Krieger shook up the field with a study suggesting that bearing the brunt of racial discrimination raises the risk of elevated blood pressure, a partial explanation of why blacks suffer more hypertension than whites. The study showed that self-reported racial discrimination is just as harmful as any of the commonly named lifestyle culprits like lack of exercise, smoking, high fat, and high salt diets. So that's just one article that people can check out. There's another one from the American Public Health Association, The Impact of Racism on the Health and Well-Being of a Nation. That article's much newer. You can even listen to that recorded webinar. There's a number of speakers and webinars that people can go through and everything like that. So you can even Google search all this kind of stuff. So racism does impact people's public health. So if we want to stop this public health crisis, one way to do that is to stop or eliminate racism. I know what you're thinking. Yeah, good luck with that, Cap. Here's another story. It was fairly significant, but did not get as much attention as the Botham John or any of the other police shootings and convictions, certainly not to my attention. Maybe other people were well aware of it. But this is from the New York Times, a white Alabama officer guilty of manslaughter for killing a black man. The officer shot Greg Gunn after initiating a stop and frisk encounter as the unarmed man was walking home from a card game in 2016. So this guy is walking home from a card game. He gets pulled over about 3 o'clock in the morning. And the police officer has an encounter with him. The man runs away. During the encounter, the officer tries to tase him a number of times. After tasing him doesn't work, the man then pulls out the gun and shoots him. The officer, his name is Aaron Cody Smith, was 26. He was patrolling the Mobile Heights neighborhood in February 2016 when he stopped Greg Gunn, who was returning home from a late night card game. According to Mr. Smith, Mr. Gunn fled midway through the stop and frisk encounter. Mr. Smith chased Mr. Gunn, used his taser on him 3 times, struck him in the head with a metal baton, and fired 7 bullets from his gun. 5 hit Mr. Gunn, who died steps from his home. He later said that Mr. Gunn, 58, fit the description of a black man in dark clothing who had previously run from him in an area where burglaries had been reported. He also said Mr. Gunn tried to strike him with a paint pole during the encounter. Prosecutors said Mr. Smith's account had many inconsistencies, including the struggle that broke out after he patted down Mr. Gunn. Mr. Smith did not turn on his body cam and dashboard cameras after getting out of his vehicle to stop Mr. Gunn at 3:20 a.m. We are very confident in the facts of this case, said the district attorney after leaving the courtroom. Mr. Bailey, who was a district attorney, said his office would ask for the maximum punishment, which is 20 years. Mr. Smith remained in custody after the verdict, and his lawyer, Mickey McDermott, said he would appeal. So, pretty interesting story, and this is, of course, Alabama. Listen, I'm not making fun or light of the fact that a man lost his life, nor of the fact that an officer has gone to prison, or is more than likely looking like he's going to go to prison. So this is a serious matter. And, when I talked to with my daughter, if you guys listened to that episode of the movie review that my daughter, El Boogie Jr. and I did, when she talks about she doesn't believe people, she doesn't believe an officer when they talk about fitting the description. So this is a problem. And apparently this encounters like this are what causes her to be skeptical of the police when they say that people fit the description. I do not know if there was burglaries that night that Aaron Cody Smith talked about, or if someone actually did run away from him as he alleged, as part of his defense. However, we know that there is a lot of skepticism towards those words about people fitting the description. So got to be very mindful of all that kind of thing. In my militarization episode, I talked about another situation called civil asset forfeiture. And I thought I had someone to come on and talk about civil asset forfeiture. That person backed out. Nevertheless, civil asset forfeiture and just police asset forfeiture overall is such a hotly debated topic in this country. And something happened in South Carolina where it may be a very significant, it may have very significant ripples upon those who are conducting civil asset forfeiture. Now, the difference between just regular asset forfeiture and civil asset forfeiture is civil asset forfeiture, if you can imagine this, you're driving down the street, and these are real stories that I've had, that I've actually read. Somebody's driving down the street and you get stopped by the police. They see or determine somehow that you have a larger amount of cash on you that they think you should not have. They ask you why you have such a large amount of cash. You tell them, well, listen, I work for a cash business, or whatever excuse you tell them. They can then say, okay, here, we're going to take this cash, but you can be on your way. Don't have to write you a ticket. They don't have to do anything. They don't have to arrest you, and they can just take that cash. In order for you as a citizen to get that cash back, you have to then sue the state, sue the county, whoever has taken your money, and you have to prove that you have a cash business and that everything is legitimate. It can take years for this to go through, and it can take years for you to get your money back, 18, 17, 18 months sometimes. And it's just a disaster. And then if you do win, you have to pay for any type of lawyer fees and court costs that you have. So this is just a ridiculous system that we have in this country. It's completely legal in many states. Fortunately, according to the story from the GreenvilleOnline.com story, right, the Greenville News from Greenville, South Carolina, this is a story in which one judge down there has understood this problem and has taken the hard line. So just sit back and listen to this. A South Carolina circuit judge in Horry County has ruled the state's civil asset forfeiture law unconstitutional and in violation of the U.S. Constitution's 4th, 5th, and 14th Amendments. Earlier this year, the Greenville News published coverage of a 2-year investigation into civil asset forfeiture in the state of South Carolina. The series called Taken, you guys can Google Taken as far as the civil asset forfeiture story that the Greenville News has done. You can read about this, or I'll even link it in my show notes if anyone gets the show notes. The series called Taken addressed questions that were raised by legislatures, attorneys, and citizens. Journalists with the news, the Anderson Independent Mail, and the USA Today Network examined more than 3,200 cases in South Carolina from 2014 to 2016 and found, here's some of the things that they found. Agencies in South Carolina seized more than $17 million from people over the course of 3 years. That's a lot of stops, and that's a lot of money to be taken off the citizens in civil cases. Listen to this. The bulk of that money ended up in the hands of law enforcement to pay for drug crime fighting. Nearly 800 times when police seized money or property, no related criminal charges were filed. In another 800 cases, someone was charged with a crime but not convicted, and they're keeping the money. This is me talking. Back to the article. As part of recent reforms, 15 states have made forfeiture dependent on criminal conviction. South Carolina has not, though efforts to reform the practice are ongoing in state legislature. About 65% of the cases involve black men, though black men make up just 13% of the state's population. I wonder who the police are targeting when they're pulling people over and just kind of taking their money, ripping people off and taking their money. Who are the police targeting? Prosecutors have up to 2 years. Here's another thing that this investigation has found out. Prosecutors have up to 2 years after police seize money to file a civil court case justifying the seizure. On average, when a person petitions to have his money or property returned, the case takes 17 months from the time the seizure to be resolved, regardless of the outcome of any related criminal charges. Completely separate. So even if you win your court case, any court charges, you still might not get your money back for another 17 months.
The judge in this case's last name was John. His decision
found that South Carolina forfeiture laws violate both the federal and state constitutional protections against excessive fines by allowing the government to seize unlimited amounts of cash and property that aren't proportionate to the alleged crime, right? So if you are arrested for a larceny six, $250 or less, the state cannot take your car, which is worth $5,000, right? Because that fine is in excess of what you took, of what you are alleged to take.
Or the penalty that would have been imposed by the court.
I hope that makes sense to people. Indeed, they allow the government to seize unlimited amounts of cash and other property when no crime has been committed, without a criminal conviction and without proof of a crime, and have been committed beyond determination of probable cause. This is what the Judge John wrote. The decision came in a civil forfeiture case of Travis Lee Green on behalf of the 15th Circuit Drug Enforcement Unit. Agents with the Drug Enforcement Unit, DEU, made three controlled buys of cocaine from Green and eventually charged him with two counts of distribution of cocaine and one count of trafficking cocaine, records show. A search warrant executed on Green's Myrtle Beach home found a backpack with more alleged drugs. Agents found $19,800 in the closet and another $971 on Green when he was arrested. John found that the amount seized by agents to be in violation of the constitutional prohibition on excessive fines. Here's what, in the judge's opinion, makes the South Carolina's asset forfeiture illegal and unconstitutional. In his order, Judge John ruled that South Carolina's forfeiture statute violates state and federal laws in four ways. First, the prohibition on excessive fines. Next, due process, in that they placed a burden on the property owner to prove their innocence. Remember, this is what I talked about when I said they take your money, you have to go to court, you have to sue the state, and you have to prove, the burden of proof is on you to show that you got this money legally. That's not the way that our criminal justice has always been. It's always on the state to prove that you have done X. And here you have to prove that you didn't do anything wrong. Due process, by institutionally incentivizing forfeiture officials to prosecute forfeitures. In other words, if the police are going to get the produce, a large bulk of the produce of the fines of the money that they seize in order to continue their activities, then of course they're going to continue to go out there and look for people to stop, people to arrest, people's money to seize. And who is often and always the low-hanging fruit? You guessed it, the black males. Black males who are 13% of the population down there in South Carolina, but yet 65% of the cases of asset forfeiture, according to this article. So once again, who are the police targeting? The state is incentivizing them to go out there and look for and gather this money. They're telling them, if you go out there and collect all this money, you get to keep it. So you get these new toys and new upgraded weapons and new upgraded cars and night vision goggles and all this other militarization, right? Remember what Marilyn Mosley said, militarization is all over the place. You get to keep all this kind of stuff. So here's the incentive to do it. Due process by institutionally incentivizing forfeiture officials to prosecute forfeitures. Due process because they do not mandate judicial review or judicial authorization prior to or subsequent to the seizure. Those are the four ways the judge saw that this laws that what they're doing is violation of the Constitution. South Carolina's forfeiture laws would allow law enforcement to seize millions of dollars from a person, even when the maximum fine authorized by law is minimal or when no crime has been committed at all, John wrote. The order laid out the reasons why the state's forfeiture scheme, this is what the judge wrote, he called it a scheme, provides an unconstitutional incentive to prosecute cases. Forfeiture revenues at each agency are directed to a designated special revenue fund, and these funds are used to pay for program expenses for discretionary items that would otherwise be unavailable to the law enforcement agencies and to pay for recurring expenses, creating a secondary budget within each agency that is not subject to legislative approval and that results in agency dependence on forfeiture funds to continue paying for these expenses. The city has their own agency, right? And with that, they're supposed to pay the salaries. They're supposed to pay for upgraded equipment and all the other paperwork. That's how they're supposed to pay for everything. With these slush funds and schemes, essentially, now they can get these extra toys, right? It's the incentive to do all this kind of stuff. You want all these extra toys. You want new equipment, new uniforms. new microphones, new tasers, new night vision goggles, all this kind of stuff in order to continue your war on drugs, well, here's the incentive to do that. The existence of forfeiture programs at law enforcement agencies depend on revenue generated by forfeitures. Forfeiture revenue is used to justify the salaries of forfeiture officials, and declines of forfeiture revenue may result in the elimination of forfeiture official positions. So if we got these forfeiture and gang task force and drug enforcement units, DEU units, and special prosecutors who are hired to do this kind of stuff, and they're supposed to be paid from this forfeiture money, well, of course, they're going to continue their program of seizing money. Of course they are, and this is the incentive to do it. In practice, officials involved in forfeiture programs control how forfeiture income is budgeted and spent with little or no oversight from the legislature. Very, very sad. Very, very sad. So fortunately, this judge in Horry County actually got it. So I want to talk about a little bit about Colin Kaepernick and how that plays into what goes on. Now, I'm not much into speaking about sports, but I do want to talk about the social implications of what Colin Kaepernick's movement has had. Colin Kaepernick obviously is the former professional football player in the NFL who began by sitting down protesting the playing of the national anthem because he wanted racial justice to be provided across this country. He wanted to help to bring attention to, and of course, the stopping of the killing of unarmed black men across the country. Whether you believe or agree with his stance is irrelevant. It's what he did, so we can have a discussion about that. All this happened in 2016. Fast forward to 2019, a lot has happened in between that time. He's actually won a court case in which he was paid an untold amount of money by the NFL because of their decisions to keep Colin Kaepernick out of the NFL. It was a collusion, and the NFL settled with that. 32 NFL team owners colluded with one another in order to keep Colin Kaepernick out of the league. They then settled that case, and they cannot talk about it. It's been rumored that he only got between 10 and 20 million. I think that was extremely, extremely way too low. You've been kept out in the NFL and the revenues and denied property rights and all that kind of stuff, and all you're going to get is between $10 and $20 million if those rumors are true. I don't think that's enough, but hey, that's what he settled for. He also got a Nike deal worth millions of dollars. So Colin Kaepernick is not starving by any stretch of the imagination. Why do I bring him up? Well, we understand within this month of November that he was invited by the NFL to go to a combine or to a camp and have a tryout. There was a lot of going on with that particular tryout. I don't really care about it, but there was a lot of shenanigans going on. The practice facility was moved. I guess there was some kind of issue as far as the waiver that he was going to sign. It's not the traditional waiver that is signed by people who are trying out for teams from the NFL. In case, of course, he gets hurt, he cannot sue the NFL if he gets hurt or whatever's going on. He wanted to know who was going to be his receivers, all this kind of stuff that's been going on. Here's my opinion about what Colin Kaepernick should do. I think that he should continue with the social justice fight that he started. I think that that's a good place for him. He's got plenty of money. Become a commentator. Continue with your social advocacy, social justice work. In 3 years, a person's abilities will naturally decline. And here we are expected to believe that after his exodus from the NFL in 2016, here he's supposed to come back in 2019, 2020 season and be just as good. I think that that's a little far-fetched to believe. He was not the greatest quarterback when he left. He certainly was good enough to play in the NFL at that time, and I would assume is today, but your skills naturally decline, and so just go ahead and just take this money and just kind of go off into the sunset. And you've got plenty of fight left in you as far as social advocacy, social justice reform that you can do, so I would suggest to do that. So why did I talk about all that? Well, his reverberations, the ripple effect of what he has done, is still spilling over into 2019, and people, students, athletes, and many other sports, many other genres and venues are still taking a knee around what they perceive to be social injustices by many police departments. And so here's a story that is actually very, very disturbing, and it comes from the Detroit Free Press. The name of this article is Detroit Denby coach. Denby is a high school in the state of Michigan. Detroit Denby coach says Almont, another high school, fans hurled racial slurs at players during confrontation. The postgame fracas between members of the Detroit Denby High School football team and Almont High School escalated as Denby players were spit upon and cursed at, endured racial slurs, according to witnesses. Detroit Public Schools Community District Superintendent Nikolai Vitti said Sunday the school district was withholding any possible disciplinary action pending a review of Saturday's Division V state semifinal football game, which was called early in the fourth quarter because of excessive personal fouls. Almont, which was the school that and parents from the school of Almont were actually ones hurling the racial insults. As players were exiting the field, tensions escalated after a Denby player shoved an Almont band member. Almont fans then began hurling racial slurs at Denby players, some of whom reacted by throwing helmets or shoes or climbing fences that separated fans from the playing field. According to the Denby coach, Dion Godfrey, the racist remarks included the N-word and began as early as when Denby players took a knee during the national anthem before the game. So before the game even started, these Denby players took a knee, and that just set the tone for the game. Obviously, it pissed off the Almont parents as well as the players. Here's what the coach of Denby High School said. "Our cameraman is white and was filming near some Almont fans," Godfrey said. "During the national anthem, before the game even started, right? This is the national anthem. During the national anthem, he overheard them saying, 'Look at these N-words taking a knee,' and they don't even know why they're doing it. And they kept going." Denby's white coaches also were being called wiggers, right? That's with a whiskey, a W, wiggers, Godfrey said. "And grown men and women started spitting on our kids as they walked up the ramp. They were throwing food, cups, and whatever. They called my student trainer a little monkey, and they were saying, 'Who let them off their leashes?' Godfrey said. They need to be on a leash. They never should have been here in the first place." A punch was thrown, Godfrey said, and after Almont parent bumped my player and the player bumped him back, the parents punched the player in the face before my player started running to his aid. No arrests were made, according to the Oakland County Sheriff's Department, but a spokesman said Monday's officers are still investigating the incident. A Denver player was briefly detained to ensure his safe removal from the situation. Almont players and coaches were not involved in the fracas. So, here we are. How post-racial are we, America? How post-racial are we? If parents and students, according to this article, if any of this is true by the coach, what he's saying, are throwing items at players. We have a grown adult punching a student. We talked before about how black men, black young boys who are kids, high school players, high school students, are viewed by members of the other community, the dominant society. Do they view them with the same amount of innocence that other people are? I don't think so. I don't think that you go up there and just start punching. I don't think that any adult in his right mind, 35, 40-year-old, 50-year-old adults, should be putting their hands and punching students. Does anybody think that that's okay, despite their size? So here we are. How post-racial are we? The effects and ripple effects of what Colin Kaepernick stands are still reverberating through the country. Think about it what you will, but here we are. Who started this, we'll never know. We may never know. But obviously, according to the article, the tone of the game was set during the national anthem and seems as if people were upset. The article goes on to say that there was a lot of personal fouls being called and that they, being Denby, could not even get their... never had a really a chance in the game. Referees ended the game in the fourth quarter because of aggressive play. Denby had -1 yard of total offense through three quarters and did not have a first down until 6 seconds in the fourth quarter. So maybe they were just overmatched and maybe all this anger just kind of built up in them. Godfrey was upset at the discrepancy in penalties. The official score sheet had Denby penalized 16 times for 174 yards and Almont flagged 8 times for 26 yards. Here's a story from the Sacramento Bee out there in California. It says dozens of California deputies lied about booking evidence they collected. Second audit shows. Orange County District Attorney blindsided this week by results of an internal audit that showed widespread mishandling of evidence by deputies, is demanding answers from the county sheriff after learning a separate audit showed dozens of other deputies lied about booking the evidence they collected, the Sacramento Bee has learned. Friday's revelation comes days after the Orange County Register uncovered findings of a two-year audit of more than 98,000 reports that showed nearly 30% of all evidence collected by deputies was mishandled in violation of department policy, that nearly three-quarters of deputies filed evidence in 6 to 10 days instead of at the end of the deputy's shift per policy, and that some evidence was not booked for a month or longer. The audit results of which were obtained by the Bee spanned February 1, 2016 through February 1, 2018. 4 deputies lost their jobs, 7 others were disciplined, and 17 criminal investigations were sent to Spitzer's office in the wake, but no criminal charges were filed. Spitzer is the Orange County District Attorney. His name is Todd Spitzer. Spitzer's office letter revealed results of a secondary audit of 450 cases and another bombshell. No evidence was booked, and nearly half of the 121 reports where deputies had said they collected and booked evidence. In 57 of the reports, deputies failed to book a piece of evidence that they stated had been collected. It was not known Saturday whether criminal charges will result from the secondary audit as detailed in the letter. This is damning, you know, and this kind of thing really puts a damper on the public confidence, the legitimacy, the procedural justice, as I talked about in a recent episode of Captain Hunter's podcast, that the people have with their police department. And so this is some of the reason. And what happens when you lose that police legitimacy? What happens when people lose confidence in the public trust? What happens when you over-militarize the police? What happens when you have asset forfeiture? What happens when all these stories get out? What happens when these viral videos get out? What happens when people go to court and can't trust the police that their evidence has been booked properly and within according to the rules? And what happens when all this kind of stuff comes to a boiling point? Well, then you get a situation like this. In Oklahoma, police say officer got Starbucks with P-I-G on cups. This is from the ABC News. In Oklahoma, police chief says an officer bought Starbucks for 911 dispatchers working on Thanksgiving, only to find that pig was printed on the cup labels. The officer notified Kiefer Police Chief Johnny O'Mara, who called the store and spoke to a manager. O'Mara says they offered to reprint the computer-generated labels, but he took to social media and posted a photo. It has since gone viral. All right, so they're putting this on. They're not just handwriting this. They're printing it out. Oh, man. And this is what Starbucks employees are printing out the words pig and putting them on officers' cups and for their dispatchers and all that. The officer told KTUL-TV that the employee reached out to him personally and apologized, saying it was a joke. However, in a Friday statement, Starbucks said the worker who wrote the offending word on the cup used poor judgment and is no longer a partner after violation of company policy. This language is offensive to all law enforcement and is not representative of the deep appreciation we have for police officers who work tirelessly to keep our community safe, the statement said. So, but this is what happens when, I mean, why would he do that? Why are we not seen as community members, people who deserve and are worthy of respect, people who are worthy and deserving of admiration? It's because of what I talked about with how people view the police, what's going on in Baltimore, what Marilyn Mosby said about the civil rights concerning African Americans. It's about the not collecting and processing of evidence. It's the over-militarization that we go down to South Carolina and talk about, that a judge has now step in and say that this is practice is wrong. It's about the shooting of unarmed people. This all puts a damper on the relationship. Officers have to try to fix that. I'm not excusing what this former employee of Starbucks did. I'm just trying to understand it. And if we understand it, then we can make changes to fix it. He's rightfully not working for them anymore. He did use poor judgment and bad taste. However, in order to fix this relationship, in order not to get these things to be done, Every side has to make efforts to step into the right direction. The public does. I would also put more onus on the police because they are the paid professionals. They are the ones who are supposed to have the thick skin, and you're supposed to be professional. If they are going to book evidence at the end of their shift, then at the end of their shift, evidence needs to be filed, booked, and processed. And stop this idea of asset forfeiture. Even though it's legal by the state legislature, doesn't mean that it has to be a practice by police departments. And it's hurting public relationships. So maybe they ought to stop doing that. This idea with Colin Kaepernick, you know, I don't know. This idea that's going around that people are still protesting, still kneeling, and people are still angry about it. You know, I don't know. What I do find to be interesting about that particular case with the Denby and Almont situation is what the cameraman has supposed to have heard, that if it's what is supposed to have heard, is that these kids are kneeling and don't even know why. Well, I do wonder if the kids know why they're kneeling. And I would also question that parent or person who said it. Do you know why they're kneeling? And I think that question goes both ways. Do the kids know why they're kneeling? Are you just doing it because Colin Kaepernick? Are you doing it because you know someone who has been unfairly impacted by the criminal justice system, specifically the police? And or to the parents, do you know why he's kneeling? Do you think that there's any type of injustice or injustices going on? Got to have these conversations, people. Got to have them. Got to have these conversations.
Also, take a look at the situation as it unfolded. Black high school students are kneeling in protest of racial injustice and prejudice that are being precipitated upon them, and or they're feeling and standing in solidarity with those who it has happened with throughout the country. And what do these presumably white parents call them? The N-word. You have to be able to see the hypocrisy in this. You have to be able to see how this unfolds out. So if we don't like how you're acting, we don't like what you're doing, then you're automatically the N-word, right? And this is the racial justice and harmony that they're trying to bring attention to. And yet this hypocrisy and yet this blind spot remains ever stronger amongst these people. So how do you get through to these people? So if you protest, you're an N-word, and you protest, if you protest racism and you protest the problems within society, then you're the N-word. Well, don't you see as the parent, don't you see the hypocrisy of this? Don't you see the problem with that they are protesting their treatment, protesting what you're calling them? And they're protesting the police, obviously, but the police get their marching orders essentially from the public, right? They are authorized. They are approved of by the public. And if the public is doing this, then the police are going to think that it's okay. If the public sits on juries and allows the officers to get off and refuses to hold them accountable when they do negative things, then they're going to do this. And if the secret conversations that go on in people's homes is about calling people the N-word, then that's what people are going to grow up and think and believe. And that's how their police officers are going to behave. So I hope that the irony of this and the hypocrisy of this becomes glaring in this guy's face, if any of this story is true, or whoever said it, guy or a gal. So that's it. Listen, there's a lot of stories we could go through, but I think that these stories kind of touch us concerning where we are and how we need to go forward and understand these things, right? We have to deal with this civil asset forfeiture, have to deal with this over-militarization of the police. We got to deal with police officers saying and falsifying records and not doing their jobs. We got to deal with all this kind of thing. We got to deal with this marijuana culture and understand that if you want to dry up the black market, which would dry up a lot of the violence, then we got to make sure that it's not overly and highly taxed. So therefore, people are not continuing to be driven towards the underground markets. All these things have to be considered. So I hope I gave you guys something to think about for this week. So once again, hit me back in the email, cptlhunter@gmail.com. I'm on Twitter, cptlhunter, Instagram, cptlhunter. Remember, you can support the podcast through Patreon, patreon.com, Captain Hunter's Podcast on Patreon, Venmo, Cash App, and PayPal. All of those are cptlhunter. Remember to hit up my stepson if you like the artwork that he's done. That would be PMDesign808@gmail.com. Support these young brothers as they do what they got to do.
Until next time, much love and peace. Take care. Bye.